think Professor Schmidt was unduly optimistic, and I think Professor Dornan will do his best to balance off the even.
Thank you. I might suggest, by way of opening, that those of you who know Bill Schneider might ask him sometime today about a nickname he acquired earlier in 1974. He's known in some quarters now as Buddha Bill Schneider. I can't, for fear of massive retaliation, explain to you where that nickname came from. It did stem from a trip we made to Vietnam together earlier this year. But I will suggest that if the full story were known, it would take its place in the folklore of our movement alongside the legendary exploits of such people as Wilmore Kendall, Fritz Wilhelmsen, and Bob Schudinger, who I notice is not here today, and so therefore may have an additional one of his own to add to that folklore. But you may ask Bill sometime about that nickname. I've been asked to talk about England, where I spent some time earlier this year. And obviously, in 15 minutes, can only begin to hit some of the highlights of the crisis that confronts England in our time. That crisis is in part political, part economic, in part social, and probably above all is a crisis of the spirit. And above all, most of all, perhaps, it's important to note that England's crisis is, in many of its dimensions, at least 100 years old, stemming from the transformation of Britain's place in the world economy, which began to become apparent as early as the 1880s, when England's agricultural and industrial produce became increasingly subject to competition from abroad, markets began to dry up, and the rest. Now, these problems, for a variety of reasons, did not become fully apparent until after World War II. The reasons for that have been well analyzed by economic historians, and I won't go into them. And neither is it necessary to explain exactly what caused the problems to become especially acute and especially apparent after World War II. It had to do with the effects of the war, the loss of empire, and other factors, which are well known. But they began immediately after the war, the stop-and-go, crisis-boom, crisis-pattern, which has characterized the British economy ever since, and a pattern whose basic cause is that Great Britain, for at least several generations, has been living well beyond her economic means. That basic problem has been exacerbated by the economic Neronianism of the nation's political leaders, who quite literally have fiddled while the nation's economy, or the foundations of the nation's economy, have been eaten away by the fires of inflation and relative declining productivity. And in looking at the current crisis, if one is an inveterate collector of newspaper clippings, as I am, one only has to go back to 65, and so at the time of the first Wilson government, and one sees the same kinds of things being discussed in the press, inflation and declining productivity and union power run wild and the rest of it, savings and investment declining, references to the fabled the lack of productivity of the British worker and the rest of it. While I was in England, a story was making the rounds, which does shed, I think, some light on this particular problem, the problem of a worker productivity, allegedly a shop steward, upon hearing of Heath's announcement of a three-day work week, said, well, if the Prime Minister wants us to actually work 3 days a week, we'll have to renegotiate this contract. And it's interesting to note that the work week was cut by 40% to 2 days, and yet the statistics indicate that output declined by only 6 to 10%, indicating to a lot of people that the 3 days are more than enough to do basically what had been done under a five-day week prior to the crisis. So these kinds of things are well known. talk of the inflation rate, you've all heard the figures, 17% for the last 12 months, a possible 20% level for calendar 1974. Real disposable income is off. I hadn't heard the figure 6%. In England, the economists are talking about 4.5, but anyway, the point is clear enough. The profit squeeze has become acute, which means once again postponing or canceling programs for investment and plant expansion and the rest of it. Government policies once again haven't helped. Until recent adjustments announced in the Healey budget, corporations were allowed to pass on to the consumer only one half of all wage increases, and believe it or not, were not allowed to take inflation into account at all in computing earnings for tax purposes. This meant that corporate taxes were being paid on inventory profits, which inventories, of course, had to be replaced at higher prices. And according to one set of calculations, when these illusory profits were subtracted from the real earnings of British corporations, all of British industry earned only $560 million during the first half of 1974, which was less than the tax bill. which means that the economy was literally running in the red in that most basic of all senses. And the consequences of that are obvious. Increasing pressure on the financial institutions. Unemployment levels are rising again, and once again we have a balance of payments gap, which has now reached a level of $1 billion equivalent a month, which is more than used to be the entire annual total. And the effects of that have been concealed only because of the willingness of the Arab countries, as Professor Shute mentioned, to recycle a substantial amount of oil money back into the British economy in the form of short-term deposits and investments and the rest. Should that money ever be withdrawn, England's problem would quickly approach that of Italy, which is leading us down the road, as Bill Rusher mentioned. But even these statistics, I think, don't get to the core of the problem. The core of the problem has to do with political leadership and with the power of unions, and that brings us to the Wilson government, whether it can deal effectively with any of these problems. He operates, as you know, under the most narrow of electoral margins, 3 votes in the House of Commons, and is depending upon his so-called social contract to keep union wage demands in line with some basic objectives he set in terms of economic stability. But the trade union members, many of whom are open members of the British Communist Party, or at least avowed Marxists, are emboldened by their victory in the energy crisis of last winter, and they believe, not without reason, that it was their unyielding stance on the wage issue which brought the government down. One of them, Hugh Scanlon of the Miners Union, with whom I spoke, has publicly stated on numerous occasions that his objective is nothing else than total revolution in England, and that if Wilson, he told me quite directly, that if Wilson proves unwilling to lead England in that direction, then the unions would find someone who can and will. And the Miners Union itself, you may have noticed, recently voted down a government offer of a bonus for extra production, arguing that this would be an undue imposition on the workers. And Scanlon himself was adamant against any such approach. It would be divisive, he said, and anyway, it would get in the way of social revolution. So we have the specter of an energy shortage, at least, raised again for this winter. The government has stated that it needs to keep wage increases to within 10% for 1974 and 5 if progress towards economic stability is to be made. The Trade Union Congress has said that 20% should be the norm. And in the first big wage renegotiation that took place after Wilson took office in February, the workers at the Ford plant won a wage increase of 38.6%, hardly a hopeful portent for the future. Even if Wilson is able to contain the unions, he'll have to battle far leftist in his own cabinet and in his party leadership, people like Anthony Wedgwood Benn, Peter Shore, Ian McCardo, and others. No less than 80 members of the Labour contingent in Parliament belong to the far-left Tribune Group, and a dozen or more of these are thought to be members of the British Communist Party, and a Labour MP told me that he believes at least 25 of the Labour contingent are actual members of the Communist Party itself. Leftists in the cabinet and in the party group have already been sniping at Wilson on a variety of issues, the Simontown Pact with South Africa and the rest. And if the economic situation worsens and the government is compelled to impose a wage freeze, which many observers of the British economy believe to be likely, such leftist pressures on Wilson will substantially intensify. Even if he succeeds in containing the more outrageous demands of the trade unions, there seems to be little possibility that he can persuade the nation at large to accept the kind of economic austerity necessary if Britain is to once again begin to live within her means. Most experts feel that would require, at the least, a 10% drop in the British standard of living over an 18-month period, and I never heard any appraisal as optimistic as Professor Schmidt's about possible increases in real output during 1975. Nothing resembling a 10% income drop is, of course, within the realm of the politically possible. And so what I think we can expect is that the government will attempt to drift along, introducing further measures of nationalization. The ports, shipbuilding, North Sea oil, and the aircraft industry are all ticketed for takeover during the coming 12 months. The government will continue with its mild reflationary policy in an effort to prevent unemployment from reaching the 1 million mark, considered a benchmark that has a great emotional content in England, and hoping that the Arabs don't pull their money out, also hoping that a worldwide recession will pull down the prices of raw materials and keep the trade balance from getting totally out of control. In other words, another attempt to muddle through in a period in which pressures and strains have stretched the texture of the British economy to the absolute breaking point. Keep in mind, too, that all this takes place against the background of Wilson's commitment to renegotiate the terms of Britain's entry into the common market, in the process of which he has pandered to all of the old insular England first anti-European attitudes characteristic of Great Britain in her imperial heyday. And remember here that when Britain first made the decision to enter the market in 61, it was the common British view that she would be doing the EEC a favor if she joined. That attitude is still prevalent in England today. And oddly enough, these attitudes linger on, albeit in transmogrified form, in the Labour Party even more than they do in the Tory Party. Should Wilson attempt to keep Britain in the market, which seems to be his intention, after having negotiated only cosmetic changes in the terms of entry, thereby antagonizing the anti-market sentiment of the Labour Party, once again the pressures on him from the left will grow intense. And should this situation regarding the market coincide with an economic crisis and a wage freeze, there is a likelihood the Wilson government will fall. In fact, under those circumstances, there is no guarantee that the Labour Party will be able to survive in its present form. A number of Labour MPs from both the left and the right wings of the party told me that a split in the Labour ranks is far from inconceivable, and many of those on the right, and I spoke at length with several, appeared to be facing that prospect with a great deal of equanimity, although there is no unanimity or even clear thinking on what they would do in the event of that kind of a split. Some talk about Powell, others talk about joining the Liberals, others talk about a complete realignment of the English party system. And, of course, the dilemma that such people face is exacerbated by the paucity of, the lack of clarity in the Tory party's leadership structure. Here we have chaos in the wake of Heath's defeat, some sentiment for Whitelaw, some for Robert Carr, the former Home Secretary. Keith Joseph, some of you may have heard of him, very brilliant economist and very intelligent fellow generally, is clearly going to make a bid for the leadership. He's a strong monetarist, an economic conservative generally, but he's attracted a substantial bad press in recent months because of a series of controversial letterings on social problems. Most notable among these was his proposal that the government take measures to popularize birth control techniques among the working class, on grounds that the quality of the British population stock was being threatened by what he called overbreeding among the lower classes and those least fit to produce quality offspring generally. His remarks were widely publicized. In fact, the quotes are even more damaging than that. And these remarks were widely publicized and may have really finished him off. A little bit of Barry Goldwater, I guess, in Mr. Joseph for all of his education. And the Liberals obviously offer no viable alternative, neither do the Nationalist parties offer much hope. Time is beginning to run. Let me just to conclude by noting that, in my view, Britain's national malaise is much more than the sum of three parts economic crisis and two parts bankruptcy of political leadership. To get to the core of the problem, you've got to look, I think, at the popular attitudes engendered by generations of economic crisis, by generations of economic leadership bankruptcy, which mark it and suggest its depth. Class envy and social attitudes, which portend future class warfare, are clearly intensifying rather than weakening. There's a political and social militancy in recent union demands that is quite lacking in this country, even as far as we have fallen, and that bodes ill for the future, which indicates just how far Britain's social fabric has been torn. Industrial growth is therefore constantly threatened by an ideological extremism which shows no signs of diminishing and which no longer seems amenable to the usual forms of political manipulation, even though the present prime minister is a past master at that sort of thing. And alongside a widespread conviction, so deep runs socialist ideology these days in England, that no matter what goes wrong, it is the responsibility of the state to deal with it and to alleviate the consequences, there exists a widespread dissatisfaction with both parties and with the nation's political leadership generally. So the public seems generally persuaded, as Bill mentioned in connection with Italy, that the problems which face Great Britain are beyond solution. And one finds, both in pub talk and in extended conversation with members of the nation's political elite, little sense of national purpose, of drive, of enthusiasm. When a visitor such as myself talks of sacrifice and asks whether the existing situation does not cry out for a revival of the Englishman's fabled willingness to put self-interest aside in moments of national crisis, One is all too often asked quite directly in return, sacrifice for whom or for what? It's in this light, too, that it becomes useful to reflect upon the startling appeal of two new paramilitary groups which have sprung up in the last year, one headed by a former NATO Northern Command General, Walter Walker, whom I interviewed, and another by a World War II legendary figure named David Sterling. One group is called Civic Action, that's Walker's group. The other is called GB75, indicating where Sterling thinks things are going. And these groups propose to offer an alternative to government in the event of a total collapse of a system. Contributions are pouring in, membership applications are pouring in as well, and there is open talk in the British press of the possibility of a right-wing or military coup. Such talk, I think, is unduly alarmist. I talk to countless military types presently in service and retired, and there's no doubt that of all of the military, the British military is as non-political as any in the Western world, but the fact that such a possibility can be openly discussed in Great Britain, I think, indicates how far the current crisis transcends mere economic problems and has begun to touch the very legitimacy of the regime itself. And then there are the little things, the kinds of things that Bill mentioned in connection with Italy, the marked deterioration of service in the fabled underground, in part because no one can be found to staff the entry-level positions. I'm about done. The continuing decline in service in restaurants, the notable increase in crime and vandalism throughout London. And even as one walks the streets, so one cannot help but observe the growing self-absorption of the average Britisher and the manifest decline in the good spirits and unfailing courtesy which has been his hallmark for centuries. To conclude, Britain may not be on the verge of immediate collapse. She's muddled through before and may muddle through again, continuing in her gradual slide through the twilight to the darkness. But that slide, to me, seems to be inexorable, and it's sobering to reflect upon the likelihood that the United States is following in her path, and perhaps following much more closely than even the members of this gloomy group believe. Because Britain's crisis, I think, raises in the most stark form possible the question asked by Bill Rusher in his conclusion as well, can the representative republic survive the age of mass democracy and the democratic economy? And on the record, the prognosis seems quite bleak.
That was much more like it, and I feel more comfortable with that kind of pessimistic outlook. Just...